cash transfer and the program that you're running?
I think, you know, all around the country, there have been basic income guarantee programs that are started. There's a guaranteed income community of practice where there are hundreds of programs around the country. And I feel like what we really need to do is to all work together to influence all of our state legislatures to make a big investment in cash transfer basic income guarantee work. This is the kind of program that is trauma-informed. It supports people in a way to get out of homelessness and out of poverty that's very dignified and that retains ownership for folks. And I feel like this is just, we've seen for so many decades that this is the kind of intervention that truly changes people's lives. And we're focusing here on outcomes. I think so much of our homeless services and our anti-poverty work focuses on outputs, the number of shelter beds that we're providing, the number of meals we're providing, the number of hygiene stations that we offer in the community. But we're not tracking the outcomes. We're not tracking the changes that are made in the lives of the people that we serve. Our cash transfer program shows, we have so much data to show that this truly changes the outcomes for families that are living in poverty. And for me, it's a no-brainer that we need to dedicate policy solutions and funding to work in a way that ends homelessness and ends poverty for people across the world.
Brandi Tuck, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Policy for the People on KABU Community Radio. Remember to help us reach our $75,000 Catalog of Connections year-end campaign goal. Show your support today at kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Thanks, and we will see you next
time. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
We know a KABU community membership is at the top of everyone's wish list this season. Give the gift of supporting grassroots community media by making a donation during KABU's Catalog of Connections campaign now through December 31st. Our $75,000 goal will go towards everyone's favorite music, news, and public affairs programming all year long. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thank you and happy holidays.
Good morning and thanks for listening to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KABU is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. This morning,
a very special episode in which we're joined by Lisa Neville and Matthew of KABU's monthly adult storytelling show, Gremlin Time.
Say, before we get started, you know, we got to establish sometimes that a movie is actually a Christmas movie. You know, there's certain criteria. So I want to ask the professor about this movie we're going to talk about. First off, you know, does it take place during Christmas?
Yes.
And is there a romantic couple in the movie?
Yes.
And do the romantic couple go ice skating?
Yes, they do, Matthew.
You know, we're almost like a Hallmark movie at this point.
Yes.
I don't know if I need to ask the next question, but is there a man with a white beard in this movie?
That's very funny. Yes. So this movie is called The Man Who Came to Dinner. And the protagonist, it's an ensemble film, really, but I suppose you could say the main character, the man who came to dinner, does have a white beard, although I don't think anybody would mistake him for St. Nicholas.
Pecan butternut fudge.
Oh, my, you mustn't eat candy, Mr. Whiteside. It's very bad for you.
My great-aunt Jennifer ate a whole box of candy every day of her life. She lived to be 102, and when she'd been dead 3 days, she looked better than you do now.
We're talking about Monty Woolley, who plays the title character in this 1942 Warner Brothers adaptation of the hit play by Moss Hart and George S. Kaufman. which ran for 938 performances. This movie was also a big hit and made a star out of Monty Wolf.
Please,
stand back, please. Don't come too close. I have several contagious diseases.
It made him as an actor, and the studio was really concerned about putting him in the role because he was a very brave public homosexual. He lived his life freely and openly in the public in the 40s, and he also presented himself as the individual that he was. And the studio was a little bit concerned that this would be a problem, but it wasn't. He's absolutely wonderful as this character who really, his sexuality is really not an issue because this character really is very sexual.
So in The Man Who Came to Dinner, we have this famous commentator, essayist, lecturer named Sheridan Whiteside.
Oh, to think that this great man is coming to our house for dinner. Ernest, aren't you thrilled?
Well, that depends. What are we having for dinner?
Ernest, haven't you a bit of culture in you? Haven't you any respect for this first man of American letters?
He's an elite intellectual New Yorker. He comes to the Midwest, Ohio, some small industrial town in Ohio, which to him is like going to purgatory. But he's there because, and this is established at the very beginning, he's doing it as a favor for one of his oldest friends.
I simply will not sit down to dinner with Midwestern barbarians. I think too highly of my digestive system.
But Harry Clark is one of your oldest friends.
My stomach is an older one.
And Mrs. Stanley is president of the women's club.
I wouldn't care if she was the whole cabinet.
And it's important to Harry's future lecture bookings. You can't let him down.
And so even though he's a mean, vain, petty, egocentric, nasty man, in many ways, from the very beginning, we see that he has a heart. And I think that's enough. Yeah.
Besides Betty Davis, we've got the Grant Mitchell and the very delightful Billy Burke as Mr. and Mrs. Stanley, whose house this is taking place in. And just as Mr. Whiteside is going up the stairs to the house and delivering another witty response.
I'm saying it has many points of interest. There's a crystal cave. That's just a short drive from here.
And the petrified animals.
Are they coming to dinner too?
He slips on the ice, ends up breaking his hip, and is carried into the house where he's got to stay for the next 10 days. This, of course, becomes national news, and all sorts of deliveries of letters and phone calls arrive at the house, and the whole place is totally thrown into chaos.
Daisy, I can't wait any longer.
Ernest, he's coming out any minute. And Winston Churchill was on the telephone. And we're in all the national news magazines. Look, the idol of the airways rests until further notice in the home of surprise Mr. and Mrs. Stanley of Missalia, Ohio. Possibility Christmas may be postponed this year. What does that mean?
Well, I'm sure it's a great honor, Daisy, but I don't like this kind of publicity at all. It's a little upsetting. Phones ringing all the time, bells ringing, messenger boys running.
Sheridan Whiteside is, he's a public intellectual. So he has a radio show, he has columns in major newspapers, he's known all over the country as sort of a tastemaker and an arbiter. He has a call in to Eleanor Roosevelt, he has calls in to major the heads of studios, major stars, important politicians. He's somebody.
Since this corner druggist at my elbow tells me that I shall be confined to this moldy mortuary for at least another 10 days, due entirely to your stupidity and negligence, I shall have to carry on my activities as best I can. I shall require the exclusive use of this room, as well as that drafty sewer which you call the library. I want no one to come in or out while I am in this room.
What do you mean, sir?
But we have to go up those stairs to get to our rooms, Mr. Whiteside.
Isn't there a back entrance?
Why, yes.
Well, then use that.
It's hard to describe how much of a farce this is. This is a farce. This is a satire. This is a very witty drawing room comedy. It's very quick. It was written by Kaufman and Hart. It's extremely witty dialogue. It's fast-paced. People come and go very quickly.
I shall also require a room for my secretary, Miss Cutler. Let me see. There'll be a great many incoming and outgoing calls, so please do not use the telephone. I sleep until noon and must have quiet throughout the house until that hour. There'll be five for lunch today. Where's the cook?
Mr. Whiteside, if I may interrupt.
You may not, sir. And now will you all leave quietly, or must I ask Miss Cutler to pass among you with a baseball bat?
Now look here, Mr. Whiteside.
There is nothing to discuss, sir. Considering the damage that I've suffered at your hands, I'm asking very little. Good day.
I'll call you from the office later, Daisy.
Not on this phone, please.
And despite the fact that he's somewhat acerbic and insulting to people, they love him. They chortle when he insults them. It's, in a sense, his insults have no impact on them because they don't take him as such.
Well, I think I can safely leave you in Miss Cutler's capable hands. Shall I look in again this afternoon? If you do, I shall spit right in your eye. What a sense of humor you writers have. Oh, by the way, it's really not worth mentioning, but I've been doing a little writing myself about my medical experiences.
Am I to be spared nothing?
Would it be too much to ask you to glance over it while you're here? Trapped.
Also introduced at this point is the newspaper man, Bert Jefferson, here played by Richard Travis.
How about an interview, Mr. Whiteside?
I never give them go away.
Mr. Whiteside, if I don't get this interview, I lose my job.
Well, that'll be quite all right with me.
You don't mean that, Mr. Whiteside. You used to be a newspaper man yourself. You know what editors are like. Well, mine's the toughest one that ever lived.
You won't get around me that way. If you don't like him, get off the paper.
Yes, but I happen to think it's a good paper. William Allen White could have got out of Emporia, but he didn't.
You have the effrontery in my presence to compare yourself with William Allen White?
Only in the sense that White stayed in Emporia. And I'd like to stay here and say what I want to say.
And such he proves to be able to hold his own words, against both Maggie and Whiteside.
But the Journal was my father's paper. It's kind of a sentimental point with me, the paper. I'd like to carry on where he left off.
So you own this paper?
That's right.
This terrifying editor, this dread journalistic Armageddon, is you yourself.
In a word, yes.
I see.
And joins a group of locals who become part of Whiteside's group.
Sherry, the next time you do not want to see anybody, just let me know and I'll usher them right in.
And in the course of him and Maggie settling in, Whiteside also makes friends with the two teenage children of the Stanleys.
I'm afraid that when we first met, I was definitely unpleasant to you. For that, I am sorry, and I wish that in the future you wouldn't treat me like something out of Edgar Allan Poe. How do you like my new tie?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Whiteside. This makes things so much pleasanter, and I think your tie is very pretty.
Well, now that we're on speaking terms, Mr. Whiteside, I don't mind telling you I've been admiring all your ties.
Do you like this one?
I certainly do.
It's yours.
Well, thanks.
Really, this curious legend that I am a difficult person is pure fabrication. Ice skating, eh? Ah, me. I used to cut figure eights myself, arm in arm with Betsy Ross waving the flag behind us.
Oh, it was wonderful on the ice tonight. Miss Cutler and Mr. Jefferson were there.
Maggie skating?
I got a marvelous picture of her.
They seemed to be having a wonderful time.
Did they indeed?
Say, Mr. Whiteside, would you mind
now,
if I...
Now, part of the real genius of this play is how the plot and the chaos and the different characters and the pacing all mixed together. And so here we have the story's plot, which, like the Hallmark movie we mentioned earlier, we've got the romantic couple. So his secretary is now getting interested in the local newspaper man, and this doesn't sit well with Sharon.
Good evening. What's the matter, dear? Cat got your tongue?
Don't look at me with those great cow eyes, you simpering Sappho. Where have you been all night? Playing house with Bert Jefferson?
I've had the most wonderful evening. I've been ice skating for the first time in my life. They tell me I'm the first person to do a figure eight from a sitting position.
We are not amused.
Bert read me his play. It's superb. It's not just a play by a newspaper man. It's really superb. Cries out for Cornell. Will you send it to her? Will you read it tonight?
No, I will not read it tonight or any other time. While we're on the subject of Mr. Jefferson, you might tell him that I am suing him for your salary since he takes up all your time.
Oh, Sherry, it's not as bad as all that.
Haven't even been able to reach you, not knowing what ice cream parlors you frequent.
I don't know how it's happened, Sherry. I can only tell you that it has. It's hard for me to believe myself. Here I am, a hard-bitten old cynic, behaving like Winnie the Pooh and liking it. Discovering the moonlight and ice skating and...
We're leaving here tomorrow. Hip or no hip, we are leaving here tomorrow. I don't care if I fracture the other one. You get me a train schedule and start packing. I'll pull you out of this, Miss Stardust. I'll get the ants out of those moon...
It's no good, Sherry. It's no good.
I'd be back on the first streamlined train.
Oh, it's completely unbelievable. Can you see yourself the wife of the editor of the Messenia Journal, having an evening at home for Mr. and Mrs. Stanley, Mr. and Mrs. Dribblepuss, and the members of the Big Sisters Benevolent Association?
Right, so this is not a screwball comedy. It's not a comedy about a couple coming back together.
It's a Shakespearean comedy. What happens is some outside influence often comes in and disrupts a world. The world becomes completely chaotic and disrupted, and the world has to be reestablished. So in this case, there's two worlds. There's the nice Midwestern town and the nice Midwestern family that Sheridan Whiteside and Maggie come into and completely disrupt. But then also, there's Sheridan's little world, which gets disrupted by the love when Maggie falls in love. And so the two worlds are kind of, you're right, that it's an interesting twist because the two worlds kind of coincide and influence each other in strange ways that to disrupt each other. So this nice Midwestern world starts to come into Sheridan Whiteside's world and upset that, as just as he comes into the nice Midwestern world and upsets that. So they're both and in danger and risk of being completely chaotic and being destroyed. And so what's interesting to see is the way in which they both get reestablished at the end.
And also in that theatrical tradition of plays and movies of an alien integer entering into a established home and taking it over. And I'm thinking of Joe Orton's play, Entertaining Mr. Sloan, but also the Pasolini movie, Teorema, where this mysterious stranger played by Terrence Stamp comes in and seduces everybody, the son, the daughter, the mother, and the and I think that feeling of being a threatening agent is part of the, say this, but kind of a gay sensibility.
It definitely upsets gender roles too. I'm thinking of Performance, the film, the Nicholas Rhodes film, which is,
oh right,
that's exactly what happens. And that film completely, you know, sort of plays with that gender identity stuff. That's very, and that goes all the way back to Shakespeare. That's
mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah,
so Monty Woolley plays a character based on Alexander Wolcott, who was a public intellectual who was a homosexual. And then there's another character that comes that's based on Noel Coward, who plays it in a very sort of very flamboyant way. I mean, they just, it's a lot of fun.
As you may notice, we're bantering around a lot of names here of sort of the intellectual elite almost of that time in New York. And this is the Algonquin Roundtable. And the origin of this movie is kind of interesting. Alexander Wolcott had asked Moss Hart and George Kaufman to write a play about him, and they couldn't come up with anything. And then one weekend, Wilcox, I guess, who doesn't travel very much, went out to Moss Hart's house out in Connecticut, and it was just a nightmare. He just took over the place. He took over Moss Hart's bedroom and the servants and everything. And so the next Monday, Hart's talking about this to Kaufman. And Kaufman says something like, geez, imagine if he'd broken his leg and had to stay there. And there they go. And the play almost falls together from that.
The sense of disruption is really common with the Christmas movie genre. For example, It's a Wonderful Life. The angel comes in to try to stop Jimmy Stewart from committing suicide and showing him that the life is not... So his worldview is undermined. And then even the common one, like there's one, a Christmas movie called It Happened on Fifth Avenue.
Yeah.
Starring Charlie Ruggles. It's about a rich industrialist.
Absolutely.
Whose house is invaded annually by a homeless guy. And the homeless guy is not unlike the angel in It's a Wonderful Life, where he changes people's worldviews and brings together people didn't know that they wanted to be together, if that makes sense. He reunites a husband and wife and helps start a new married couple.
Well, I would say that the Christmas movie and the Christmas story since Charles Dickens, you know, is that movie that pits the sort of individual drive, the capitalist drive to create wealth for oneself against the collective Christian ideal of brotherhood and humanity working together in love and harmony. And it's the only time that, you know, it could really get away with suggesting that the latter has any kind of purchase in our culture, right? So mm-hmm. So here we go. So we have these Christmas miracles that reestablish this sort of wonderful idea of brotherhood and humanity and love as opposed to greed and Potterville, Hooverville, right? But this movie, The Man Who Came to Dinner, is different. It's not The Bishop's Wife. It's not It Happened on Fifth Avenue. It's not the Christmas Carol. It actually doesn't have that kind of tension. So there really isn't any kind of tension in this film, except this kind of like just wonderful upset. So everything that gets reestablished, I mean, in fact, it's almost mocked, this sort of notion of this collective brotherhood. I mean,
okay, New York. Cream of mush brings you...
Monty Woolley has there's a little bit of his Christmas Eve radio broadcast.
Sheridan Whiteside.
It's so sentimental and nobody takes it seriously. Betty Davis puts it, it's so gooey. When she typed it, it stuck to her fingers.
Whiteside speaking. On this eve of eves, when my own heart is overflowing with peace and kindness, I think it is most fitting to tell once again the story of that still and lustrous night.
But then the Christmas day, everything that happens, everybody's heart opens on Christmas Day. So there's still this sort of indication that there's something, that something magical can happen to people on that day. It's still a Christmas movie.
I know what we'll do, Doctor.
Yeah, come along, Jefferson.
Let's climb down a couple of chimneys. I got a friend that doesn't believe in Santa Claus. Let's climb down his chimney and scare the pants off of him.
Here is Hart and Kaufman delivering a Christmas movie, but mocking the whole thing even while they're delivering it, because even though it's not as overt as, say, with Ebenezer Scrooge, there is a transformation.
Whiteside does change his mind. I mean, he is to stop Betty Davis from following through with her love affair, and then when he sees that she's really brokenhearted, she's really serious, he changes his mind, and he and this character played by Jimmy Cagney.
Jimmy Durante character, you mean?
Yeah. He's based on Harpo Marx.
You're gorgeous. You're beautiful.
Put me down.
I love
Put
you,
me down.
Madly.
Are you here?
Madly,
Put
do you hear
down.
What I said?
Completely over the top. Crazy character.
Kiss me. I can feel the hot blood pounding through your varicose veins.
Andrew.
Whiteside, will you sign for this package, please?
Put that woman down. That's my nurse, you mental delinquent.
Come to my room in a half hour and bring some rye bread.
You could talk this insane idea to get rid of Ann Sheridan, and we shouldn't tell how it's done because it's so...
It's gotta be good, Sherry. Lorraine's no dope. Now, there must be something that would get her out of here like a bat out of... Say, I think I got it. That Englishman she's so crazy about. What's his name again? Lord Bottomley. That's it, Bottomley.
No, Banjo, no.
Wait a minute, you don't catch on. We send Lorraine a telegram from this bird.
I catch on, Banjo. Lorraine caught on, too. It's been tried.
Oh, I told you Lorraine was no dope. Well, you've got a tough proposition on your hands.
Betty Davis initiated this movie, The Man Who Came to Dinner, to be made from the play as a role for her. And it's a very different role than like what she had just done in like The Little Foxes and other movies where she's like sort of the lead, the figurehead in it. But here she kind of steps back. She underplays her role. She really plays off of Monty Woolley, even though I think she wanted John Barrymore in the role instead. But it's hard to imagine anybody else, even John Barrymore, sober as the role of Sheridan Whiteside. Monty Woolley just puts his stamp on it in this film. It's really good. Another actor that appears in this for the first time is the wonderful Mary Wicks, who is a character actor. She was even in Sister Act. She was still making movies that late.
Well, and you know, Monty Woolley, when he went on to have such a good career, he was in the last Christmas movie, I think, that we reviewed, The Bishop's Wife. And he has a character part in that movie, and he's my favorite character. He's just very different than this film. He plays a very sincere, warm, hearted woman.
Now, it was Betty Davis who saw the play and decided that this would be a good vehicle for her, a nice change of pace in the character. And so she convinced Warner Brothers to produce the movie from the play. The Epstein brothers, who would work on Casablanca, they were brought in as the screenwriters. But really, the play is so solid that in many ways, the film production just kind of gets out of its way. And it's kind of interesting that the male ingenue, played by Richard Travis, he isn't as electric as, say, Jimmy Stewart or William Holden, but it really kind of works towards the play.
So it's interesting how the love romance, he's there, he's the motivator of the plot, but as a personality or a character, he kind of steps back a little bit from the two main characters. Also a kind of break from tradition in a way. So this is, if you liked Arsenic and Old Lace, if you liked You Can't Take It With You, you'd love this movie, The Man Who Came to Dinner. 1942, Warner Brothers. The director, he didn't do too many other films like this. And that's what's, I think, one of the criticisms is that it's not so much an auteur film, like, say, George Cukor or Michael Curtiz making it. But it's a very solid studio movie with, you know, the character actors and the photography, and especially the editing at a Warner Brothers film. The play itself just really cranks up. I mean, it starts off kind of slow, but by the time we get into the latter part of the third act, there is so much crazy stuff going on. You can accept the fact that someone's being thrown into a mummy case and that an octopus is being brought in. I mean, that's earlier in the film either. But and a thing that Hart did, Moss, Hart, and Kaufman did, they would introduce interesting characters later in the film, in the play. They wouldn't bring them all in at the beginning. So we have the character doing Noel Coward comes in the second act. Jimmy Durante's character, based on Harpo Marx, comes in at the beginning of the third act, which really cranks things up. And at the end, we have a clock ticking because Whiteside is going to be kicked out of the house. Besides meddling in the affair of his secretary, he also advises the son and daughter of the household to follow their dreams and take off and, you know, get their life started, which I kind of thought was a little bit of an imposition on him, on his part.
Well, one thing you can remember is that Alexander Wolcott was known as a leftist, and some people thought he was a communist and a supporter of the Soviet Union. And so, you know, this character is supposed to be a communist as well. I mean, he keeps calling Eleanor Roosevelt. At the very end, Billy Burke, who we haven't mentioned because she's almost wasted in this film, but she has this wonderful little part, and he answers the phone. It's Eleanor Roosevelt calling Sheridan Whiteside, and she says, "Oh, Mrs. Roosevelt, my husband didn't vote for your husband, but I did."
You don't think it's all got something to do with Mr. Whiteside, do you, all these goings-on?
Mr. Whiteside? A lovely man like him? No.
Unlike a lot of films made in the 40s, it feels very modern. There's not a lot of, you know, cultural racism and sexism and all these sort of that mar a lot of films from that era. So you can actually watch it.
So that's our Christmas movie pick of for this year, the 1942 comedy from Warner Brothers Studios, The Man Who Came to Dinner, adapted from the play by Moss Hart and George S. Kaufman, starring Betty Davis and Monty Woolley. Also in the cast is the delightful Mary Wicks, Jimmy Durante, and Billy Burke, among a few others. It's included in the list of 100 funniest movies ever made, and that's The Man Who Came to Dinner, 1942. And for Lisa Neville and myself, we just want to say Merry Christmas.
And you are listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Please consider becoming a member today. And thank you for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching your screens.
Whiteside, I'm here to spend Christmas with you. I think I may stay a month, or I may leave immediately. I don't know. Things are so uncertain. Did you ever have the feeling that you wanted to go and still have the feeling that you wanted to stay? You knew it was right, wasn't wrong, still you knew you wouldn't be very long. It's tough to have the feeling that you wanted to go, still have the feeling that you wanted to stay. Start to go, change your mind, start to go again, but change your mind again. It's tough to have the feeling that you wanted to go, still have the feeling that you wanted to stay. Do re mi fa sol la si do, I go. I'll stay.
Oh, will you shut up, you reform school fugitive?
Whiteside, I love you. I love you.